Okay. It's a joy to have you all with us. I think this is safe to say that we anticipate we're barely keeping this on the rails, and we haven't even started it yet. All right, I think it's safe to say Commandments 3 and 4, this is going to be an interesting evening, and I think an interesting conversation in lots of different ways, because in many ways, these are commandments that are going to be very familiar to you, and in other ways, they may be commandments that miss us, that we may actually look at these, and when we give them really close consideration, we might think to ourselves, huh, I don't know how I have seen that applying in my life, and we want to sort of drill into that as we go.
There is a thing about the language that is helpful here. When we read, you shall not misuse or take the name of your Lord God in vain, we hear one thing. But it does help to remember that for the Israelites, in the Hebrew language, they literally had a name. It says, you shall not take the name of Yahweh, your Elohim. Elohim means God. Elohim is a description of what God is, but Yahweh is the claim of who God is. So when it says name, it literally means name. We, in English, kind of shove all that under the word God. So for the hearers of this, it is important to know that they literally have been entrusted with what they understand to be God's actual name. So the idea isn't just for them, stub your toe and, you know, God dang it. The idea is that they call on God's name, Yahweh, in vain. And so I think as we get into this, it does help to keep in mind and at least to whatever extent possible, try to see this from the lens of people who believed they had been given their God's actual name. The not just a title or a description, but a relational component of who God actually is. And I think that helps a little bit.
Okay, so we're going to just start right from that place that Clint begins with. And the idea of, when we think of this commandment, is it safe to say, would you largely agree that when we think of not using the Lord's name in vain, we generally think of that as do not cuss, do not swear, right? What happens when you hit your thumb with a hammer? Be careful what comes out of your mouth, is what we think, right? And in a very particular way, I think we need to start there to name that. Because if that's connected to the commandment, and I think it fairly is, it's connected to the smallest part of it. And it's not even a holistic understanding of the small part it's describing. And we're going to hope to really expand that. And to understand that, we're going to take over here that classification of words that we would use as, I'm just going to call them cuss words. Words that we've socially said, this is inappropriate. Soap words, that's right. The seminary professors would appreciate that. You should send that to them. The soap words. All right. So you got your soap words over here. Okay. So we've got that here, but we're going to pause for a moment and we're going to come over here and we're going to talk about religious words. We're going to talk about words of substance and meaning. Okay. And in the ancient world, there is this concept of the idea of oaths, of oath giving. But there's also this idea of swearing to or swearing by. And the idea behind this is relatively simple. If you have access to someone who's above you in the totem pole, and you can say, in the name of so-and-so, you do this for me, and that would work, you would do it, right? And the idea is, if you have access to the name of a god, and you can, in that God's name, declare things to be true, and it works, then you should do that. And so people would use oaths, or they would swear by gods, and they would say, by this God's name, you do this. And depending upon where you were, what time you were, that may or may not be effective. That may or may not help you. But As that goes, we have statements in the scripture like Jesus, you might remember, says, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. He said, you know, don't swear by the heaven or the earth or anything between them. The idea behind that is connecting to this idea. Do not try to utilize created things so that you can exercise authority over other things. I promise. I'm moving to someplace that's a little bit more practical here quickly. But what that means is that when you start swearing by other things, you start having a kind of connection to that thing. You become subject to that thing. And so if you start claiming, hey, you need to do this in the name of this person, you've now made yourself a connection to that person. And so in that case, what ends up happening is you start claiming that you have the power of gods using the name of gods, which violates the commandments last week, right? You see how if you start trying to exercise the authority of God by calling upon other gods to do what you want, now you are putting a Lord above the Lord. And that violates the first and greatest commandment. So what you say is not just in the matter of soap words, it's in the matter of allegiances, of deepest religious value. Who do you see is your Lord? And if you believe that is the God who called you out of Egypt, which is what we had in the very first part of these commandments, then you know you shouldn't be calling on other gods to do your bidding. Those two things don't live together. And so we come right out of the gate in a kind of denial of the people using God's name to their own benefit. Oh, right. Okay. So, yeah, we were searching for what is the closest analog for this, because I know that seems dated, right? I doubt the last time that you had someone come to your house and say, buy Thor's hammer, make me soup, or whatever it is, right? So this is a bit outside of our experience, except for if you've ever had a family member, or you yourself maybe have spent some time in the prosperity gospel world. Many of you know that's a thing I was conversant in as a child. The logic in that community of faith goes like this. If you're sick, or if your bank account is low, or if your children are not respecting you, what you need to do is you need to say, in the name of Jesus, I call you to do this thing. I call you healthy. I call you to be respectful. I call my financial situation to reverse. And then they say, you need to do some things. You need to give some money. That's convenient, of course. You need to give some money, you need to say some prayers, you need to do some other things. But when you do that and you keep saying, this happens in the name of Jesus, they say, prosperity gospel teaches, it's going to happen for you. I submit to you, that's exactly what this commandment is calling us not to do. The commandment is telling us that we don't get to use Jesus' name to do whatever we want. What was Jesus's prayer? Thy will be done. Now, let's be clear about this. Jesus is the Son of God, full member of the Trinity, praying, thy will be done. We as humans show up to prayer and we start using Jesus's name to win lotteries and to go on trips to some place. That is the kind of abuse of the divine name. That's exactly in mind in the commandment here. It's when we try to leverage God for our own sake, that is a violation of what the spirit of the third command.
And I don't know if there are equivalents in each case with Protestants, but I do remember a well-meaning, but I suspect not theologically educated Sunday school teacher I had as a young person telling our small class that if you didn't end your prayer with in Jesus' name, God couldn't hear it. And I remember these prayers and then thinking, oh, crap, did I say the magic word at the end or not? You know, and if you'll bear with me for a minute, the word vain, you know, sometimes you read this commandment, you shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God. That's perhaps closer. It's not a better translation, but it may be a better capturing of the meaning. The word vain in Hebrew means empty. In other words, you shall not take the name of Yahweh, the living, creating God of the universe who has adopted you as a people, and treat that name as if it is empty, if it's devoid of meaning. You shall not empty the God of heaven and earth's name. And it, you know, you could maybe even, you shall not make God's name small. And I would argue, when you, even well-meaning, tell a group of kids, you have to say this the right way, or God can't, you won't get your prayer. You might be doing that. So important is this commandment that's one of very few in the Ten Commandments that carries a warning. And it is a heavy warning. This one has a punishment attached to it. No one who misuses the name of the Lord your God will be held innocent or guiltless. Think about that for a minute. As we read the Ten Commandments, we could have lots of discussions about the editing and the transmission, whatever else. But as we read the Ten Commandments, as they have come to us, we have the God of heaven and earth saying, I take this so seriously that those who do it will not be made clean. They will not be considered guiltless. We have to be a little careful mixing New Testament and Old Testament language, but there's a sense here of they will not be forgiven. Now, we know that ultimately that's not what it says, but that's the idea. That's the threat behind that. That this is so serious to the people that it carries the threat that God won't forget if they do it. God is not going to not remember, oh, you did this, you people did this, or you individual did this. And Michael and I were talking before this session, what is interesting about that is, it would be fun, maybe at the end of this Lenten season we'll try this, it would be interesting to try and rank the commandments in modern life from least important to most important. I suspect don't misuse God's name would be high on the least list. I think most people think, oh yeah, I shouldn't cuss in public, or I should, you know, yeah, I should watch my mouth. But I don't think people understand this, nor do I think they elevate it, certainly not to the place where they would imagine God saying, I'm not overlooking that one. I take that one very, very seriously. I just don't think most people get there.
Yeah. I think we can make that point pretty succinctly. So I've literally had this happen. A kid makes a mistake. They're in front of their parents. They use the Lord's name in vain. I've had the parent look at the kid and say, not in front of the pastor. Not in front of God? If we take seriously the commandment, what's at stake is the creator of the universe, who has the sole right of judging those who live in sin. Who cares about the pastor? That's the least of your troubles. You should see what he said 5 minutes ago. We don't take seriously, I think, the identity of God, which is what this is speaking towards. This is a relational command. And there's a sense in which I think we've misplaced the danger of the profane because we're afraid of profanity. And profaning God is the worst thing you can imagine. But the thing that we're afraid of is not in front of the pastor. And I think that we have to reframe this commandment in our minds to see it's not about the soap words. Because I both Clint and I went to Christian schools of Christian colleges of very different stripes. But in both places, college students going around with all different kinds of euphemisms for curse words, right? And all of them clearly referencing the thing that you're not saying. Well, At the end of the day, does God care if you include this word or this word? No, it's Jesus makes it clear. It's the substance of the heart. And so at the end of the day, if we're going to take the third commandment seriously, I think we have to move away from this idea. How many times in a week did I say a word on this list? And we need to move away from that to a way of understanding, have I honored God with my speech this week? That's an entirely different construct, and it requires us rethinking our relationship with God. Have my words reflected the greatness of a being who took on flesh to die for me? Which, by the way, I'm going a little bit off notes here. I'm going to get back on because nobody knows what's about to happen. But I'm just going to say, I think this is why in the New Testament, commandments against gossip and complaint are so prevalent. The backbiting. Because the idea is you're using your words, a la James, you're using your words to light fires that are destroying the community. And when you do that, you're cutting against the creator of that community. So I think the power of words in a Christian context has a real history in the New Testament, that we may have minimized them to be, am I using God's name in a way that fits the soap words? And I think that we have to understand that God expects us to use our words in a way that creates life like God's words create life. And that's an entirely different way of understanding what God calls us to.
Yeah, I mean, follow the point, right? We're not saying you should get out there and start throwing around profanity. You know, go drop F-bombs out on unsuspecting people. That's not it.
And say I'm Presbyterian. My pastors told me to do that. Don't do that.
I mean, there are Christians who swear boldly in the idea that we're free to say what we want. And I was telling Michael this earlier. I was at a football clinic this weekend. One of the conferences was a small group. A guy was teaching on the 11 eyes of servant leadership. So I went in, really good, teaches at a Catholic school, coaches at a Catholic school, had a lot of success, looks like he runs a really good program, lots of stuff that I learned about, and it was, I thought, well implemented. And it's very clear early on in the presentation, it comes from a religious point. He had some Jesus stuff, had some Bible quotes, but then slipped into football coach language at multiple points during the thing. And I thought, given his audience, does this help him or hurt him? I'm not sure, but I remember thinking there is a little bit of a disconnect about what you said at the front and the words you said in the middle. So yes, we should pay attention to our language. Yes, we should be people who try to speak in ways that are edifying. Michael's replacement swear words. You know, I had a teammate in college who often, when he would make a mistake, would yell cheese and rice. And people would snap their head and he would say, you know, like, technically I didn't say it. You know, and so he just, but that's not it. This is relational. The Israelites understood this so seriously, so much did they revere God's name, and I know some of this is repetition, and I'm sorry if you've heard this before, they would not say the word Yahweh. And then it got to the point where they wouldn't write the word Yahweh. They would write shorthand. In fact, Jews to this day, if they are fairly conservative, will not write the word God. You will see G/D. Now, just to follow that, that is a Jewish person who's not writing the full English word that is a translation of a Hebrew word that someone wouldn't write or say. That is revering the name of God. Now, it's a little legalistic, I'll grant you that. But they are so concerned with the idea of the sacredness of who God is that they don't want to take risk of making that small. of being flippant with it or treating it as commonplace. And that is significant. We, I think, hear this, as Michael said, as a commandment about profanity rather than its intent, which is about profaning. How is it that our words should reflect the glory and the greatness of God? How is it that our language should endeavor to make God bigger and not smaller? And how do we do that as Christian people?
So we're going to move here to Westminster here pretty quickly. I just want to share with you, I've been sharing as we go through the commandments, some of our forebearer Calvin's thoughts. And I think his thoughts as it relates to the third command are very helpful. So if you're looking for summaries, here's three takeaways from the third commandment you could easily take on an index card. Calvin says that number one thing we should take away from this commandment is that every Christian is called to use your words in a way that reflect the glory and greatness of God. So instead of measuring your words based upon a rubric of what you shouldn't say, Calvin's going to turn that back to you and say, you should judge your words by, do they stand up to the measure of the glory and greatness of God? And then Calvin goes on to say, we shouldn't use or abuse God's word or the mysterious nature of God's work in our lives spiritually. And I think that this is really powerful. He says, we should not speak rashly or perversely for the sake of our own ambition or greed or amusement, which, by the way, is all television. That's like all late night, everything after 7 o'clock on TV. Right? The idea of using words in a way that benefit us, that simply add value to our own amusement or our own vanity. The idea we should not abuse God's holy word in our life. And the third is we should not defame God's work or actions in the world. And what he means by that is, to whatever extent you see something that speaks of God's work, if you see something that speaks of Jesus at work, if you don't have something positive to say about that to the world, then you're not doing justice to God working in your life. The idea is, if you see God as a human, there's no other proper response but to give thanks for it. And we shouldn't defame God by not giving God glory for the good things that God does in our life. Which, once again, I go back to the New Testament. How many times in the New Testament do you have a command to offer thanksgiving or to be a people of joy? Why is that true? Because whenever you see God, you give thanks and you are a person of joy. That those two things are intimately connected. All right. At this point, we would love for you to all take your pads that you wrote on ahead of time, and we'll see how many you had in the four section for the third commandment, and then we'll look at the forbid section on the other side. So, third commandment requires that the name of God, his titles, attributes, ordinances, the word, sacraments, prayer, oaths, vows, lots, his works, and whatever else there is whereby he makes himself known, be holy and reverently used in thought, meditation, word, and writing by a holy profession and answerable conversation to the glory of God and the good of ourselves and others. The sins forbidden in the third commandment are the not using of God's name as is required and the abuse of it in an ignorant, vain, irreverent, profane, superstitious, or wicked mentioning or otherwise, using his titles, attributes, ordinances, or works by blasphemy, perjury, all sinful cursings, oaths, vows, and lots, violating of our oaths and vows, if lawful, and fulfilling them, if of things unlawful, murmuring and quarreling at, curious prying into, and misapplying of God's decrees and providences, misinterpreting, misapplying, or any way perverting, there's more, word, or any part of it, to profane jest. I actually want to pause here. Because there was a point in here that I'd like to lift out if I could. So one of the earliest, among the earliest generation of Christians, there was a significant amount of time and attention theologically devoted to the idea of oath giving, and specifically related to the military. And in fact, it's Augustine who wrote an entire treatise, 300? I don't have the exact date on when Augustine lived. I should. He's like a lion of Christian theology. So good job, Michael. But the whole argument that Augustine makes is essentially that if the treatise goes like this. He says, if when you join the military, you have to make an oath to the state, does that oath keep you from ultimately keeping this commandment? The idea being, if you say, I will follow what you tell me, his point was, does that supersede the oath that ultimately is required of God and his lordship to you? And it's a very long treatise, and I'm going to summarize it. He basically comes out on the other side and says, as long as you ultimately follow an allegiance to God first, then it is fair and it is reasonable for a human also to make an oath to another human institution. But I just want to point out, that is actually the history behind this idea of violating our oaths and vows, if lawful, and if our things are not lawful, right? So, I mean, this actually goes forward into our tradition. In other words, if you make an oath and the thing you make an oath for is not lawful, then your Christian duty is to not do it, if that makes sense. It's understanding that oaths actually have tiers. They have tiered importance.
Just very quickly, a little background. I think you know this. The word Sabbath, literally Saturday, in Jewish holy tradition, Sabbath begins Friday evening at sundown, lasts till Saturday evening at sundown. That is their holy time. That's when they talk about refraining from work, etc. Interestingly enough, in the Jewish tradition, lots of conversation about what you can and can't do. They have tended, and I don't mean this as an insult, they've tended to be very conscious of rules, and so they've tended to wrestle with legalism. So they have these wonderful debates about whether you can turn on a light switch or whether you can open your refrigerator, and things that Christians have in different places too, like can you garden or can you not? But they have taken it further than we have, generally speaking. Christians, in the aftermath of Jesus' story and the resurrection, Easter Sunday, in the, not probably right away, but in the first evolution of Christians, probably within a couple of decades, certainly by the end of the first century, that Sabbath concept had been shifted to what we call the Lord's Day, Sunday, the first day of the week, rather than the last day of the week. And then in Western tradition, a day began not at evening like it does in the Jewish tradition, but in the morning. So we end up thinking of the Sabbath as Sunday. This is another interesting commandment. This is the only commandment. I hope you know this. There are two places in the Old Testament where you find the Ten Commandments. One is Exodus 20. The other is Deuteronomy 5. This is the only commandment that has significantly different text in the two versions. They both say, don't do anything on the Sabbath. Keep it holy. Work 6 days. Rest the seventh. But Exodus then gives the explanation from the creation story. God created the heavens and earth in 6 days, and on the seventh God rested. You too will keep the seventh day holy. Deuteronomy says, remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and the Lord brought you out of Egypt. And it goes into that narrative. So it tells the Exodus story and not the creation story. So they both have the same commandment, but they get there through two different ways. And the general explanation for that is that Exodus is written by people who were more engaged in the kind of priestly religious life of Israel. So they reached into the creation story. Deuteronomy comes from a slightly different place. Again, the commandments don't say different things, but it is curious that only in that one instance do we see that they have different explanations. So They both get to the same place, but they both take slightly different roads to get
there. Okay, so we talked about using the Lord's name in vain. We talked about sort of the popular aspect of that. I want a quick start there for this as well. There is a general conversation that I hear all of the time in which people wrestle with, and this, I'm going to just choose a particular example. I think it is broader, but why don't young people come to church and instead choose to go to the hockey camp or choose to go to the volleyball camp or to the t-ball camp or whatever the thing is, right? And talking about how all of the Sunday schedules get filled up. And I've talked to pastors who talk about that as like, we're pushing back the pagans of the church schedule. And so I think that's like the popular conversation surrounding Sabbath. Why don't we go to church on Sunday like we're supposed to? And that is a really interesting, I think, conversation. I've talked to parents who engage that, young people in our church who engage that conversation very seriously, and they struggle with that. What do we do with Sundays? Our kid either gets to play hockey or they don't. That happens on that day. And so they wrestle with it, and they try to make their way forward in it. That's an important conversation, and it needs to be had. I think, though, that it's not necessarily even the whole of that conversation. I think it's a small part of it. I think we miss, and we should have on the screen, Clint asked me if we did, and we don't. In Exodus here, it makes it clear, starting in verse 10, the Sabbath day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it, you shall not do any work. Neither you, nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor your foreigner residing in your towns. Pause there for a second. In other words, Sabbath isn't about whether your neighbor catches you mowing the lawn. Sabbath is about a society that says the foreigners within your bounds should not need to work on that day so that they can have a day of rest. It is a command to justice. It's to say that as a society, God created in 6 days so that there was an abundance on the seventh. We should live in a kind of society that abundance is enough for everyone that lives within your borders. So it has a kind of expansive corporate nature to it. I do think that we are tempted to turn it into a rather legalist command. Once again, don't get caught mowing your lawn or picking plants, or if you're in the Jewish community, don't be caught turning on the light in your refrigerator, however far you want to go down that trail. But here's the thing. When you read through the New Testament, how many times does Jesus get accused of breaking the Sabbath? It happens all the time. He keeps eating things he's not supposed to, or the disciples are picking wheat that they're not supposed to pick, and they just take him to task on the Sabbath. And what does Jesus say over and over again? Maybe the chief example of it, that Sabbath was made for man. Man was not made for Sabbath, right? And so Jesus even reorients the idea that Sabbath is not a kind of legalist structure that we serve, but rather it's a theological commitment that we will be the kind of people who live with space in our life.
And the great disconnect there is that Jesus lives in a time, and some people have carried this forward, where they believe that Sabbath means to do nothing. And Jesus believes Sabbath means to do godly things. So it's not an inactive day. It is a dedicated day. It is a day to step away from worldly things and to be particularly focused on godly things. To keep holy, that word means to consecrate, and the word consecrate means to set apart. That's all it means, to put it aside as special, not to make it ordinary, don't treat it as common, to consecrate that day. It is the furthest thing from I went to church, now I'm done and can do what I want. That's that kind of thinking, and you can see how easily legalism creeps in here. But it's not that. And we often hear it as rest, and oh, isn't it nice that the Bible tells us to take a nap? It is not that. It is not for our wellness. It's not some kind of mental health break. It is relational. It is covenantal. It is to say there should be moments, and you should be intentional in creating them, where your focus and your activity, or lack of activity, are specifically designed and directed at honoring God. So much bigger than do's and don'ts. That do's and don'ts matter, of course, but this commandment is so often reduced to the idea of what can I do and what can't I do. But it takes the wrong metric to get there. And I think that's what we see in those controversies and conflicts with Jesus. We see a people who were coming at a good thing from a bad angle. And Jesus corrects them over and over and over again.
So there's a few different senses. I'll be really brief here. There's a few different senses in which I think we see Sabbath is not a kind of construct for what you do one day of the week. It actually gets taken amongst the people of Israel, and it gets written into the entire fabric of their lives. It becomes a theological principle that they have, that you work for the majority of time and you set aside consecrated time for God, that's the pattern that one lives your life by. So that exists from the highest corporate end to the individual. Let's start at the highest end. I don't know if you've all heard the Jubilee, but every certain number of years, 49. I was 99% sure that that's right, but 49, that's good. So every 49 years, essentially all loans get reset, and property that you may have mortgaged out now comes back to you. The idea being that no one is in a position where your financial mistakes will impact every generation that follows. It's a kind of, you have a certain period of time where you're free to live, and then there's a reset. That happens at a national, cosmic, social level. But then you have the rules related to farming that I think are really interesting, because they touch both that corporate and the individual. Farmers were told you need to leave a certain amount of your crops at the edge of your field unharvested. And you need to make that available so that the poor can come to your field and that way they can be fed. That becomes a kind of corporate way to ensure that the one who owns the field benefits from that to a majority degree, but that there's some margin left so that those who don't have would still be able to eat. And so that, I think, is a practical kind of outcome that comes from this same kind of Sabbath thinking.
Yeah, and you may know this, they also practice a communal Sabbath. Every seventh year, a field was to be fallow. You could work a field for 6 years. The seventh year, you were to leave it, and the poor and the alien and the neighbor were able to go and pick anything that grew there. So there was this idea, even at the creation level, of specific rest that benefits other people. So this is woven in to a nation, much more than, yes, it was probably good for the land, but that wasn't why they did it. They did it because God commanded them to do it. Maybe the clearest version we see of this is the Exodus story of the manna, right? They could gather manna except what? Sabbath. They could get a double portion on, we'll call it Thursday. I don't know what they called it. And they would have enough for the day. And that ultimately, as I think the call of Sabbath, is think about what that means. You're not going to plant a field. You're not going to go gather food tomorrow. What does that demand? It demands trust that God will provide. What does it mean to say, I've got a lot of work to be done, but I'm going to intentionally take a day not to do it, and I'm going to focus on God that day? Can God be trusted with the outcomes of my labor? As a nation and as individuals, Sabbath was a sign of trust. We put our faith ultimately not in our efforts. There's a time for work. We put our trust in the action of God that has promised to be with us, lead us, guide us, and provide for us. And I think, you know, there's some really good upsides today. And again, I wish we could make this more about that, because I do think it carries some lessons for us.
So just two quick things as we make our way towards Westminster. First of all, I was surprised, I learned this week, how much the earliest Reformed believers read this commandment from the perspective not of this life, but the next. It blew my mind. So much emphasis was that the Sabbath was to be for us an image of the spiritual reality of being with God. And it sort of connected for me as to why, as Protestants over time, Sabbath has become less and less of a defined reality, is because at the very earliest part of the Reformation, they were already shifting Sabbath away from a day in the week in the way that they thought and talked about it to a spiritual reality of being present with God and how that shifted. And I thought that was really interesting. I think there are some Protestants today who are doing some really interesting work trying to reimagine this. I just want to, it's not really a recommendation, but if you're interested in reading of someone in contemporary Christian circles trying to think through Sabbath in ways that are applicable, the book I'd recommend for you to read is The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. It's called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. I'm not suggesting to you that the book is some kind of seminal statement on a contemporary reading of Sabbath, but it is someone who's thinking about Sabbath and trying to take it seriously in their individual spiritual practice, and it may be helpful to you in that. I want to point out, I know it may strike us because it's, you know, a few words in the midst of a longer thing, but the first day of the week ever since, and so to continue to the end of the world, which is the Christian Sabbath, you can see how that the arc of those words is pointed to eternity. And that's actually a very Reformed emphasis looking at the Sabbath. Okay, here's your forbids.
Omissions of duties required, careless, negligent, unprofitable performing of them. Profitable in that case does not mean make money from them. Being weary, profaning the day by idleness and doing that which in itself is sinful. Which is fascinating because we tend to think idleness is the point. So our reformers understood it is not the point. Doing that which in itself is sinful, needless works, words, thoughts about worldly employments and recreations. If there were standards about not doing things like basketball with your friends, that's where they came from. The idea of worldly employment set apart. There are other days to play ball with your friends. That's not this day. There are other days to do those things. This day is different. And I'll just be honest, Christians we've largely lost that. I mean, we don't carry that. I don't think you can grow up reasonably Jewish and not understand the importance of Sabbath, right? I mean, it is woven in a way that we don't know what to do with it. And so whatever we do with Sabbath, I think we'll be trying to recapture some of the best parts of it because we've largely abandoned.
I agree. And I would only add, I think it's not just recapturing in a 7-day schedule. That's where I think we get off track. I think when you look at Sabbath from an Old Testament perspective, it has a claim over your entire life. And so I think that's the invitation I would have for you to consider. Is we live in a culture in which, you know, some families have this culture, we do one vacation a year, right? And that's the idea, we recreate one time a year. I think a Sabbath understanding is that there's some patterns in your life in which you set aside the normal for the sake of doing different kind of work, which is different from, are we going to the Black Hills or not this year? Do you see that distinction? I think the question is, do you in your life ever have time when you do spiritual work? And if your answer to that is no, Sabbath is an invitation to explore what that would look like for you. And it could be on lots of different timelines. I think that's my final thought.
Okay. We'll kind of let you have your do's and don'ts. If you want to share any of them, share those with your neighbors or bring them up or whatever you want to do. We're running a little long. We want to be conscious of your time. But thank you all for your time tonight. Thanks again, the folks that fed us. We're very grateful. Have a good week, and we will be seeing you.
Hey, we want to thank you for listening to this broadcast. We're grateful for the support and the connections, the relationships we get to make through some of these offerings. We hope that they've been helpful. We know that there are lots of choices that you have, lots of things you can listen to. We want to make you aware of some of what we're doing, and we greatly appreciate you being a part of it.
Absolutely. We want to just thank you for being one of our audio podcast listeners. It's amazing to have you with us in the midst of our conversations. Of course, I hope you know that you can find the whole archive of all of these conversations at pastortalk.co. We would love for you to join us there. You can find options for subscribing by email. You can easily share things there with other people who you think might appreciate recordings like this. And of course, we just want to welcome you. If you're ever interested in joining us for the video podcast, you can do that on YouTube. It is youtube.com/FPC Spirit Lake. There you can comment and engage with us. Or if you would prefer to do that without going to YouTube, you can actually just click the link in the description of this podcast where you will be able to send us a form and information and reach out to us. We love to hear from you and engage in conversation with you. Thanks again for taking time to be with us. We look forward to our next conversation and can't wait to see you then.